Blog Talk Radio.
Welcome to Up Close and Personal with your host, Annie Latin Jazzy Rodriguez. Sit back and enjoy the journey where the possibilities are limitless. Enjoy the show.
Monday, and welcome to Up Close and Personal with yours truly. I'm sitting here having goosebumps. I am really, really, oh my God, I am tickled pink. To actually be talking with this guest is like out of the world for me. He is one of my favorite saxophonists, and I've never had him on the show before, so I will try to be at my best, but with no further ado, I would love to introduce to you guys one of the most soulful, interesting, this guy's like really out of this world. Ladies and gentlemen, Mr. Michael Litton. Hi, Michael.
How are you? What an introduction.
I could have said more, but I'm too nervous. How are you? And welcome to Up Close and Personal.
Thank you. I'm doing really well. How about you?
Oh, I'm blessed. Thank you for asking.
Good.
Well, like I said, I have so many questions. This is a real pleasure for me. I have seen you perform so many times. You've been a favorite of mine for so long, and to actually be talking with you, I am totally thrilled. So let's get started, because I know, time goes by really fast when you're having fun. So I would like to start by asking, how did you start your career? What inspired you? What made you be the awesome saxophonist, composer, that you are today?
Well, there's different tiers to what I've done over the years. I grew up in Copenhagen, Denmark, and originally I played the clarinet, but it was really American soul music that got me interested in the saxophone. King Curtis, Junior Walker, David Sanborn, and even just soul singers like Otis Redding, Sam Cooke, and Wilson Pickett. So that was sort of what got me inspired in the first place, and then once I'd moved to America, I started touring as a musician. I really didn't have any aspirations of making records. I just wanted to be a touring musician, touring saxophone player. Once I got my first big professional gig and tour with an amazing singer, Bobby Caldwell, then I got offered a recording contract. And then my whole life sort of changed at that point, and it became about writing music and making albums, and more than just being a saxophone player. So, there's been many different levels and tiers over the years.
Mm-hmm. Now, out of all the instruments out here, what attracted you to the sax?
Well, the thing was, I was losing interest in the clarinet rapidly, and it's a natural progression to go from the clarinet to the saxophone, because in the same family of instruments. But the thing about it was, I thought the saxophone was so cool. The saxophone was so cool because, if you listen to any type of music, it fits, whatever it's rock and roll, R&B or soul, or even classical, blues. It all works, and I just thought it was such a versatile instrument. And I love the sound, and it kind of looks cool too,
Yeah, and it speaks. It actually speaks what you can't say. I can't explain it the way I hear it, but it speaks such a beautiful language. No matter what you put in, it speaks so beautifully.
I agree with you. It's a very expressive instrument. And, there is a reason why the saxophones were named after. The different saxophones are named after the vocal, baritone, tenor, soprano, alto, and because I really feel that it's a very close relative to the human voice.
Amen. Now, tell me something. Let's talk about Second Nature, because this is a off-the-chain album. What was the sole purpose or the inspiration behind this beautiful album? Because it rocks. It really does.
Well, thank you. Thank you for saying that. Well, it was certainly a fun and interesting project to do. It sort of started for me with the album right before Second Nature, Soul Appeal. And I had Second Nature is my 9th album. But with Soul Appeal, I sort of had come to a point in my career where I was looking to do something a little different than I had been, and something that really inspired me, and something that I felt that I could really connect with on a deep level, and therefore my audience would be able to connect on a deep level as well. So I decided to go back to the roots of where it all began for me, which was with soul music. So that's why we did these kind of records, and basically we went back and did it the exact same way that they did it back in the 60s, coming out of Memphis, out of Stax Records, where you go into the studio, and you'd just all be there at the same time, and you'd all make it happen right then and there. I wrote a lot of songs. I didn't want to do a cover album for either one of them, so I got together with my producer, Barry Eastman, and you know, at first I told him about the idea. I want to get back into to my roots and do these soul records. And I said, but I don't want to do any covers. I want to do original music. And he didn't really have any experience writing this type of music. It was a very specific kind of music to write. And neither did I. However, I said, well, let's learn it together. And we would do a lot of research and a lot of listening to songs from that era. And we wrote almost 40 songs for Soul Appeal and 40 songs for Second Nature. And we would select the 10 or 11 best one of those and go into the studio live with just amazing, amazing musicians. And we're talking about Ray Parker Jr., Paul Jackson Jr., Freddie Washington, Teddy Campbell. Then not only that, we went to Memphis and recorded at Royal Studios with a band that was put together by Willie Mitchell's son, who runs Royal Studios. Willie Mitchell's, to the folks that don't know who he is, he found Al Green and produced all those amazing Al Green records, and he founded Royal Studios. And his son is still running it, and he helped me put together half of Al's band, the Hodges Brothers, and then half of the remaining members of the Stax Rhythm Section. And then we added Booker T. Jones and the Memphis Horns and the Dap Kings. So it was just, I mean, it just kept on getting better and better, to be honest with you.
Wow. And you could tell that you guys, and that's what I like about recording in the studio, everyone at the same place. Yes, I know nowadays, you know, it's expensive to travel back and forth or to get everybody together, you know, in one place. And they use a lot of, you know, back and forth through emailing and stuff like that. But that feeling you get when you hear the music, everyone in the same place, is like totally different. Totally.
Well, it is. It is, because that, remember, you know, I mean, it's almost like a live concert, except it's in the studio, right? So, but you can imagine when you're sitting there, whatever it was when we recorded in at Sunset Sound Studios here in Los Angeles, a very classic studio as well, or at Royal Studios in Memphis. I mean, I'm sitting there looking at musicians that have created this unbelievable musical landscape over the last 40 years, you know, whether it's Ray Parker Jr., who's has played in, and Paul Sepp Jackson Jr., played on pretty much every record ever possible, you know, or sitting there looking at the musicians that created Love and Happiness or Let's Stay Together. I mean, I'm sitting there where that music was created, and to just, I mean, if that doesn't inspire you, Lester Snell, who arranged a lot of the music and the horns of the album. See, people wouldn't know who Lester Snell is, but Lester Snell was one of the staff composers, arrangers, and musicians at Stax Record. And he did all of that amazing Isaac Hayes stuff and the Fable Singers. I mean, the list goes on and on. And you know, you just sit there and are just in awe. And I respected the, you know, the ambience, the vibe that was created, and the music that was created, and it was just so inspiring to be there and then sit there and record with these musicians that was a part of that. It takes it to another level. And I've done it the other way, where we send files around and we just kind of add music, instruments on one by one. And this is just a different experience. You know, and here's the other funny part, is that you're sitting with some of the best musicians in the world, most experienced musicians in the world, right? Well, I'll tell you what, I'm not going to be the one falling behind. So I am on my tiptoes, you know.
You have to bring it to a higher level.
And I think everybody's feeling that. Nobody wants to be that guy that, is holding everybody up. So there's a certain urgency and a certain focus. That's all I can tell you. And it's terrifying. It's absolutely terrifying that you realize that what happened right at that moment is what goes on the record. But it also, there's a certain focus and urgency that you don't get when you can sit and say, we'll just do it over again. We'll just punch that in. We'll just, fix that in the mix, whatever, So.
And the improvisations, I'm sure, that, are great. And sometimes they sound so good that you'd be like, what the heck, let's leave it in there,
Well, that's an interesting thing because, there's definitely an element of that. There was, I'll tell you a really great story about recording. This was from the first day of recording for Soul Appeal, which was the one album before Second Nature. We decided that I was going to be recording with the whole band. And in my mind, I'm thinking, yeah, that's fine. But, something happens, I can always take the tapes home with me and fix it, in my studio. So, I was so super relaxed feeling that I could do that. And so at the end of the sessions, I asked Barry, my producer, Barry Eastman. I said, Barry, hey, let me take those tapes home. So I just need to. He says, you need to what? I said, there's a couple of little spots where what I did wasn't perfect. And he looks at me, he goes, it wasn't perfect. It wasn't perfect to who? Well, it wasn't perfect to me. And he says, and that's perfect? I was like, wow, that's an interesting, it's so subjective. He says, music is not supposed to be perfect. Music is supposed to feel good. And that's what this does. Very interesting and liberating sort of comment and sort of outlook on the whole vibe. And so going into recording Second Nature, it was like, listen, if something is a little out of place, a little out of tune, it's okay. It's personality, and it's just what music is. It's not perfect. But it was at the moment. It happened right at that moment, and there was a reason why it happened that way.
Amen, amen. Well, let's play a song. I want to start with the first track, which is Beale Street. Anything about that particular song that you would like to share with us?
Beale Street, Beale Street is the first single, and that's the song that features Booker T. Jones. And, it was one of those things. When we recorded this song, I kind of felt we had something really special. And then we went to Memphis, and that particular song, we recorded the tracking, the basic tracks in Los Angeles. And then we went to Memphis, recorded the horns. And when I was in Memphis, I had this crazy idea to reach out to Booker T. Jones and ask him to play Hammond B3 organ on that song. And when he heard the song, he was like, I'm on a plane down from Lake Tahoe right now to play in this song. He loved it. And it was just a magical time with him, sitting there and just sitting in the studio with Booker T. Jones, who I've been such a huge fan of for so many years. Of course, Booker T. Jones is Booker T. of the MGs, right? So very, very sort of, the music that he created for Stax Records and during the 60s was just amazing to me.
And it still is. Well, here it is, Beale Street, from Michael Linton's latest contribution to our ears, which is just beautiful. Second Nature is one of the most fun albums I have heard in a long time. Well, here it is, Beale Street from Michael Linton on Up Close and Personal.
Mm-hmm.
such a fun song. I mean, God, you can't stop but to be dancing and be bopping.
Yeah, it was a fun one. And Beale Street is such a perfect title because that's obviously sort of the main road or main street down in Memphis where all the great music and stuff is happening. So it's awesome.
Awesome, yes, indeed. I'm going to talk about the music, but I want to know something really quick. I know that you are into other things besides the music. Do you want to talk about your cigar and winery companies? That was, to me, that was like, what? When I read that, I was like, what? I would never imagine you doing that.
Yeah, well, I mean, I didn't either many years ago, but I mean, it was something, you know, life just happens that way. And in 2006, I started a cigar company. You know, cigars has been something I've been, you know, been into sort of for the last 25 years. But, you know, just on a recreational thing, it's a great way to sort of decompress for me, a glass of wine or a cocktail and a cigar, you know. But I started a company in 2006 because I was hosting an event that had to do with cigars, and then I wanted to create my own cigar for this event, and it went so well that I ended up continuing after and just created the company and continued developing the brand. And the wine thing happened, say, 4 years ago when an amazing vintner from Paso Robles, California, called me and said that he was a fan of my music and he had an idea about creating a brand together, a line of wines. So I went up there and I met with him, and he's just a brilliant guy and had a lot of great ideas. And you know, I didn't know much about wine, except I know I love drinking it. But, you know, I got a crash course in winemaking and you know, obviously leaning heavily on him. But I do know what I like, and I do know what I think was good. So we blended some wine together. He grows all varietals up there. So we did some blending together and created some really cool varietals of white and red wine. We created a blend, and which is a Malbec Petit Sirah Petit Verdot for the people that are into wine, and a Cabernet Reserve Cabernet 2007 Reserve Cabernet. And then also a Viognier, which is a very interesting white wine. And so pretty excited about that. That has opened some doors for me that I never thought would. And I've had a lot of fun with those little two, you know, offbeat ventures outside music. And it's, you know, I always like to get involved in other things. Obviously, I'm passionate about other things besides music. It's just fun to be able to actually make a little business out of it, too, and sort of. It was really great to be able to go into a restaurant, and even more so than me, have my parents, when they come and visit me from Copenhagen, go into a restaurant in L.A. and be able to open the menu and order a bottle of my wine. I mean, that was pretty fun. Yeah.
That is epic for sure. Well, I'm going to find out how to get me a bottle. Most definitely.
Well, I mean, we made it very easy for both the cigars and the wine, even though that I have great partners and distributors. But, you know, for the wine, it's just LinctonWine.com. And for the cigar, it's MichaelLinctonCigars.com. That is sort of our home for the wine and cigars. And then, you know, once you go there, it's all information of how to get a hold of the wine and cigars from there.
Well, thank you for sharing that with me. I deeply appreciate it. But I have to get that out of the way because my family in Florida, my brother and stuff, they are into cigars, my father. I mean, I could still, like when I smell a good cigar, it brings me back to my childhood days because my father always smoked a cigar.
Right.
And wine, of course, my daughter, she's, what do you call those, wine connoisseurs and stuff. She's been to Italy and a couple of other places. You know, she's all into that. I'm just into drinking it, so I'm good.
Yeah.
Well, back to Second Nature. Stone Cool, this one features Ray Parker Jr. what was it? First of all, how was it writing for this album? Because they all original tunes except one.
Mm-hmm.
But what inspired you? I mean, I know the inspiration for this album and what you wanted to do, but what inspires you in general to write the music?
Well, I mean, this album is a little different than many of the other albums I've done because it was such a specific project stylistically. So I would submerge myself for a year just listening to soul music, you know, when every time I get in my car, it was just 60s soul music. And I would listen, go to YouTube and Pandora and anywhere I could go to and listen to soul music because I needed to submerge myself into the style and the culture and the phrasing and the way of playing and way of life and everything with that. So that was my inspiration for writing this. So I would hear a song that I maybe never heard before, sometimes by artists I'd never heard before, you know, because, I mean, we all know the Otis Redding and the Wilson Pickett and Sam and Dave and Sam Cooke and Jackie Wilson and the Staple Singers, Otis Redding, you know, Wilson Pickett, all of that. We all know those, but there's a lot of artists that that I wasn't familiar from that era. And so it'd be interesting to discover music that I'd never heard before, and that would inspire me to write a song in that sort of genre or vibe or, you know, and I would always do a little, little screenshots when I would listen in my car. I'd take a little screenshot of the screen so I could see what song and artist it was, and I would send it to my co-writer and producer, Barry, who lives in New York, and saying, check this out, do you know this song? Okay, let's write something that's like that. And then, of course, the first time we try to write something like that, it's awful. And so, but by the fifth time we try something like that, it comes out all right. So, you know, so it was a process. So it was a very sort of direct process, and so my inspiration was coming from listening to music from that era. And that's ultimately, I think, why one of the things that both fans and critics are picking up on with not only Second Nature but Soul Appeal too is that how authentic it actually is. You know, I mean, the first thing they're saying, well, is obviously that you have a deep rooted love for Memphis soul music, and that was so important to me that it didn't become a gimmick or just like a fad or something like just, oh, let's do a Memphis thing, you know, but for people to really understand that this was serious business for me. This was the real deal.
Amen, amen. Okay, now I want to skip to Soulfinger, which is the one that the only cover in the album. What was...
And that almost didn't come to be because we had recorded most of the album and I realized that we actually did not have a cover on the album. And I always like to put at least one on there. But I didn't, you know, I didn't want to put something on there that was so obvious and just kind of, it would be almost the same as the original. We had to do something with it. And so realizing, you know, that we got to do a cover, but let's do something that you haven't heard for a long time and bring back some really great memories. Mm-hmm. And all suddenly, again, back to doing research and listening to other songs. I'd done Shotgun. I had done that on a previous album, so that was out. I didn't want to do What Does It Take, because I'm looking for songs that sort of has sax in it already or something that, you know, I didn't want to just do Hold On, I'm Coming and then just playing the melody and sax. I wanted to do something that sort of originally had saxophone on it, you know, whether it was a King Curtis thing or Junior Walker thing. And also only this song I had not heard for years is one of the things that I stumble upon, which is the Barkay's Soulfinger. And I'm like, oh, my God. And I started looking up this song must have been covered a million times. And I come to discover it has not. And I was like, oh, my God, this is too good to be true. And I we recorded the whole song, top to bottom, every instrument in Memphis. And it was just, That was kind of fun. I gotta say, that was kind of fun.
Well, if it's okay with you, I would love to play Soulfinger.
Go for it.
Okay, well, here it is. Soulfinger from Michael Linton's Second Nature. And Up Close and Personal. Love it. Unfortunately, the writer, one of the founders of, he was the founder, wasn't he? Mr. Cawley, Ben Cawley. Yeah.
Well, I mean, it was a bunch. It was all most of the guys in the Bar Case that wrote the song. You know, he was the only surviving member of the plane crash with Otis Redding.
Mm-hmm.
Very interesting. I didn't find out until the next day when I'd left Memphis for Nashville that he actually passed away on the day that we recorded that song. So I certainly hope we did him proud.
I know you did. How is it? How do you feel? You know, when you're in concert and you see all these. Fans, I mean, you bring in a crowd each and every time. How does it feel to be in that stage, being adored by everyone, that everyone loves your music? How does it, you know, what does it make you feel like?
Well, I mean, you know, you can imagine, you know, the whole thing is just a sort of high in itself. You know, it's a beautiful experience because remember, I started playing music because of my love for music. and the fact that other people like what I do and love what I do and get enjoyment out of it as well. I mean, that is such a amazing and beautiful thing. I am so appreciative to every single person that comes in to my shows, or in general, just comes out and supports live music. But, you know, the fact that they decided to come to my show, you know, there's so many options today. There's so many distractions and so many things, and there's so many issues of the world and reasons why you can't go or want to stay home. But people choose to come to my show, and I can't explain to you how appreciative I am, because essentially they're allowing me to pursue my dream, and because I couldn't do what I did if I didn't have an audience, as much as I would like to think I could, but I cannot. So they allow me to just do what I absolutely love to do, and, you know, for that I am absolutely appreciative. You got to understand that I came from a very small country in Europe, and I just had a dream to come to America and be a musician. And next thing I know, you know, I'm releasing albums. People are buying my music. They're coming to my shows. I mean, it's so surpassed my original dream. And I really feel that, that I've been given such a gift, by being allowed to do what I love to do, by people coming and supporting me and my music. So yeah, it's an absolutely extraordinary feeling.
Amen. How would you define, or how would you like for this album to define you as a musician?
Well, I think it's being done right now, and I'm so thrilled about it, because I've been on the receiving end of when I intended to do something on a record, and it was not what was perceived as the outcome was. I mean, it wasn't what my intention, what people thought it was. And for this album, Second Nature, and also, again, Soul Appeal, I must mention Soul Appeal because it sort of started this whole thing for me, even though Second Nature is another level, another extension. But what's happening is people are understanding who I am, and I'm understanding who I am even more, because I feel so at home with this. And, you know, one of the questions I get asked all the time is, why is this album called Second Nature? And it really has to do with the fact that I feel that not only is this music second nature to me, but my instrument has become second nature to me as well. It's an extension of me. You know, I've always felt that, you know, I had a talent to play the saxophone, but there's a difference between having a talent and also the feeling that you have now become one with that, and it's absolutely an extension of you. So what people are picking up on Second Nature is the fact that I have sort of grown into myself. I've grown into a zone where I sort of live and breathe that is really me, and that's how I feel about it as well. But it's really wonderful that people are picking up on that, and they are by telling me how authentic they feel my sound and the style and how honest this thing is. And
it's like you were in that era. It's like you actually was in that era. It's like you were actually lived there. Like, you know, it's in your soul already. It's you. It's a part of you.
But it is a part of me, because you see, I this is the music that if you really look back at it, this is the music I grew up listening to. This is why I started playing the saxophone, and this is why I moved to America. So it really is a very, is a very important thing to me, and it's very ingrained in me. So no wonder it feels right, because it's what inspired me in the first place to do what I do.
Amen. Now, another question that I have for you, Michael. Do you think overseas that people have more appreciation for the music than we do here in the United States? Or is it shown differently?
No, I wouldn't say that. I mean, audiences around the world have different ways of appreciating music and the experience of live music. It's really very different. The Japanese have a whole thing. The Europeans have a whole nother way. The Americans have it's a different experience playing for different audiences. But I do not believe they're more appreciative to music over there. I think when you find your audience, they're very appreciative to music in general. I think people are just, when they find their own music that really moves them, then they're appreciative.
Who they could connect with when they find that connection.
Yeah, it's all about connection. I mean, the power of music, I got to tell you something. I mean, it's the power of music, the emails, the stories I get, what my songs, you know, what people have used my songs for, whatever, it's a first dance for a wedding or dealing with a loss of a loved one or whatever, it's a child dancing, you know, on a recital. I mean, there's so many things that has happened, and it amazes me, the power of music, and also anywhere in the world, it doesn't matter. I mean, it's like whatever they even speak the language, we can speak together or not. You know, music is such a universal language, and it sounds very cliches, but it really is. I mean, it's, you know, music can break down borders and anything. Music is a powerful thing. And I'm not saying this to be a diplomat. I'm saying this for my own personal experiences that has blown me away, you know, time after time. I was just in China, performing in the middle of China in a city called Shaolin, which is nothing but temples and monks up in the mountain in the middle of China. And even though they had a big saxophone sort of conference there that I performed at and also did a master class, but, you know, I had children, small children, that had just picked up the saxophone. I had teenagers. I had the adults. And, you know, they were familiar with my music there. They would sing back or play back my own songs to me on the street, on anywhere they could, you know, hotel lobby, anywhere that they possibly could. And to realize that, how do they even know about this? How did that even, you know? It really amazes me. I mean, it's like, yeah, I mean, you got radio. I mean, I knew about music when I was in Copenhagen and I listened to American music. So, of course, it has a reach. But when all of a sudden you're on the receiving end of that, some little kid, you know, comes out and he asks me if he can play back my song Twice in a Lifetime to me. And he pulls out his saxophone in the middle of the street and starts playing back to me. I mean, it's almost too overwhelming to even. I mean, this is on the other side of the world, in the middle of absolutely nowhere. And you're just going, man, the reach of music is absolutely crazy.
Wow. I know you just stood in your track like, wow. That is like one of the highest compliments, you know, to have someone, a young child, learn your music and play it back to you. That's outstanding.
It's amazing. I mean, I can't even. It's impossible. I mean, because you're obviously thinking you're in the middle of nowhere, so nobody's going to know anything, but that it couldn't be further from the truth. That's just my own opinion about it, and I was wrong, but it's been a beautiful experience, yes.
Let's talk about Memphis Stratton. What's so special about this particular song?
Well, it's Memphis Strut, not Strutton. Strut. And, Strut. Yeah, Memphis Strut. Like Soul Food Strut, but it's Memphis Strut.
Okay.
Well, Memphis Strut was kind of a fun one because this was one of those days where I'd been listening to a lot of different music and kind of like, you know, today I want to write a different kind of song. So I was listening to Amy Winehouse a lot, and then I was listening to the Fable Singers. And I called my co-writer, Barry, and I said, Barry, can we write a song that is a cross between a Staple Singer song and Amy Winehouse? And he's like, what the heck are you talking about? So So, you know, so I said, you know that backbeat that Amy Winehouse kind of uses, you know, the like the British sort of, in, you know, the soul British invasion kind of thing, you know, like that, but more with a, you know, a Memphis twist to it. And so we, you know, we came up with Memphis Drive. And and again, our demos that we recorded were nothing like what ended up on the album. That was the beauty of having such great musicians that when they heard the demo, and we were trying to convey what we were, what it is that we were going for, everybody had something to contribute. Well, why don't we do it this way? Why don't we do it that way? And, you know, and that's, it was really a very much a collaborative effort, the whole album, between myself
album
and Barry Eastman and all the musicians.
How long did it take to do this album?
Well, write it and record it, or just record it?
The whole process from beginning
okay, well,
to end.
Well, it's about, I'd say it's about a year, you know, between the writing, the recording, we recorded over 2 or 3 months. That's the mixed. So that's the least, it's more the writing that takes a long time. The writing, because you can write for days and days and come up with absolutely nothing and, or nothing good. So you got to go back to scratch, you know. So that's what takes a lot of the time for me, writing the music. Once you have written the music, you're setting a recording date and you go in and kind of do it. And at that point, it's just a matter of plugging in the correct pieces, meaning the musicians, the studios, the equipment, blah, blah, blah. You know, it becomes more technical. At that point, it's just you hire the right crew. You know, it's almost like casting a movie. Who would be the greatest to portray, you know, or to record this kind of music? What great engineer would it be? What studio should we go to? What equipment should we use? What's the correct? So that becomes a little more sort of calculated. But it's the writing of the music that really takes the longest for me.
And, you know, I was thinking that when you were talking earlier about, you know, how you had to do your homework and research the music and all of that. But to me, it seems like, exactly like you just said, it's like, you know, doing the movie, you did your casting, and
mm-hmm.
you are the star of this particular movie, except that people don't realize that you're not really portraying someone else, you're actually portraying yourself. You have come out in this album for the true Michael Lytton, all your soulfulness,
that's right.
your instance, everything about what you loved about the music. It has
right.
come in this album together for you. So you're actually portraying
yeah.
yourself in this.
Yeah, I suppose that's a good way to put it. I mean, you know, the reason I'm portraying myself, the way I'm portraying myself is because of my influence and my research, you know. I mean, that has influenced me in who I have become.
Mm-hmm.
But this is me.
Okay.
You're absolutely right. This is not like, hey, guys, I was just kidding. This is not really me. I'm doing actually this. No, this is me. This is what I do,
mm-hmm.
you know. And I think that that's why people feel it's authentic and real, because it's not nothing fake about this. It's just is what it is.
Well, I think it's one of your best albums yet, you know. I mean, I really, really enjoy it. I enjoy all your music. I know that I have all of your albums, but this one, it was something really, you know, and I couldn't wait. Because I take a break throughout the summer, come spring, you know, in the summer. And I'm like, oh, my God, the minute that I get back on the show, I have to talk to Michael. Because I really did, you know, enjoy this album. And with
thank
that,
you.
Let me go to our next song, Memphis Strut, from Second Nature. Here it is. that song. As a matter of fact, that's the current single, isn't it? Yeah, that's the current single
right.
now.
That's right.
Yes,
exactly.
Yes. Because I hear it all day long. They play it on XM. I
sure.
love that song. I mean, the whole album is so catchy, so beautifully. I mean, it's so authentic. It's so original. It's got sounds that a lot of albums nowadays don't have. You know, the quality
yeah.
and everything. And I'm really, really in love with it. And I thank you. I really thank you.
Absolutely. Well, thank you. Thanks for saying that.
I know you're about to leave. I want to play one last song before you leave. And I would like you
sure.
to tell me some about it. And that's Woo. Woo, whoa. Woo, whoa.
Woo. Woo.
Woo, okay. I said it right.
Oh, my God. I can't help laughing when I hear that. So, so my buddy Ray Parker Jr., who is, you know, one of the greatest guitar players, but obviously most people know him from, you know, singing the theme song for Ghostbusters. But but Ray Parker and I have been friends for many, many years, and he's played on many of my records actually. But so one day, you know, I say, Ray Parker, why don't you come to my house and we're going to write a song together. You're already playing guitar on my record, so let's write a song together and we'll record that. He says, you got it. So he shows up in his convertible car in my house in Los Angeles. It's a 2-seat convertible car, and he pulls up to my house. The guitar is in the passenger seat, sticking out of the car, no case, just the guitar sticking out of the case, and him in, you know, in the driver's seat, and he pulls up and with the biggest smile on his face, and he says, where do I park? And I live in an area where I only have one garage space, but so you got to park, you know, outside my house, but there's a permit parking, and somehow I had lost my permit. So I'm like, you know, that's a good question, because I don't have a permit for your car, so we have to figure that out. He goes, what? He says, okay. He says, after I find parking, he says, we got to go in and write a hit together, because I need you to be able to buy a new house that has more parking. So that's how that song came about. Yeah, so he found parking, drags his guitar into the house, and we write Woo. And he sort of had an idea already in mind, you know, and we started writing this song, and you know. It was just
and the rest
a lot
is
of fun. We recorded it and had a great time. Yeah, I mean, it's a party song. There's nothing to it. It's just having a good time, and you know, it's a party. That's all.
Well, before I play the song, what's next for Michael Linton as a musician or whatever, you know, in your personal? What is next for you after this spectacular album?
Well, I could tell you a few things are next. You know, I'm out touring right now. And as a matter of fact, got a show, Catalina Island, coming up here in a few days, the jazz festival over there. And then I'll be going to Las Vegas and Colorado Springs and Miami and Virginia. I mean, all over the place. And then next year I created a tour. I guess I could talk about it because it's already starting happening and being booked, but I created a tour called the Foreign Affair Tour, which is with two other fabulous artists, Marc Antoine and Alex Bunyong, and we call it the Foreign Affair Tour because we're all from somewhere else. You know, Marc is originally from France, but lived in Madrid for many years. Alex Bunyong is from Switzerland. Obviously, I'm from Copenhagen. So we're going to be out touring with that next year, and also, you know, in between my own dates. And then I will start writing music again very shortly and start thinking about recording a new album. I know it seems absolutely crazy since this one just came out, but, you know, knowing the time it takes to write. And I don't think I want to reuse some of the songs that I wrote. I should probably take a look at some of it, but I kind of like to start fresh, if you know what I mean. Start
yeah.
fresh. So, you know, so I'll be start writing music again. And there are some other things in the work that would be a little hard for me to talk to right at this moment, but there are some interesting other ventures that we're working on.
Awesome.
As a matter of fact, I'm getting ready to go into a meeting right now with a gentleman who manufactures my own signature line of mouthpieces. So that has already been released. Now we're just having a meeting right now. But so that was another thing besides the wine and cigars that I've been working on, the Michael Linton mouthpiece for my saxophone, because people always ask me about my sound and what equipment I use. And what I used has not been available for over 10 years. So we decided to create what I use, recreate that. And so now that's available. So that's exciting too.
Most definitely, most definitely. And you'll be in my area in February at the Murphy Fine Arts Center. So I will make sure that I get my tickets way ahead of time.
Great.
Because I would
Wonderful.
Love to come and see you.
Wonderful. Please do.
Yes, most definitely. Okay, so I am going to play Woo, but first I want to thank you for joining me today. There's still so much
pleasure.
I would love to ask, but I know our time is, but thank you. I wish you and this album the best. I mean, it's already out there and going crazy, so we're loving it. Thank you for being you. And I do have a question. Who's your stylist, your style person? Dude, you be dressing the best. You're a badass when it comes to dressing.
Oh, thank you.
I had to remember to ask that.
I do. You know, a lot of the stuff, I mean, it's just me coming up with ideas. But I mean, you know, every time we do an album shoot, there are clothes that we use for the album shoot that, you know, I use for the live shows as well. And I don't know. I mean, it's certainly changed over the years, I could tell you. I know you and I wouldn't be having this conversation about my outfits, say, 12 years ago, because it was an absolutely wardrobe malfunction on my behalf. But I do like to dress up. I think it's fun.
Well, you do it very, very well. You look very, very handsome. You are very, very sexy. And I want to say
thank you.
I'm deeply humbled to be talking with you today, and I wish you the very, very best and look forward to seeing you or talking with you for your next album.
Sounds wonderful. Thank you so much for having me on the show. Thank you.
Thank you. And ladies and gentlemen, this was Mr. Michael Linton, finally. And here is Woo.
my world was crumbling. No, I couldn't see it then. When I finally understood it, baby, you were out the door. In the burning trail behind you, I was ashes on the floor. There ain't nowhere to hide.
That was All Right from Michael Linton's new release, Second Nature. I'm about to play the last song from Michael's new album. But before I do, I just want to remind you all that tomorrow I will have Paul Jackson Jr. On Wednesday I will have guitarist, Latin jazz guitarist, Russ Hewitt. And on Thursday I will have Bill McGee of 804 Jazz. And on Friday I will have Blend Jazz. So tune in for a show, anytime. And so back to music. The next song is going to be on a Sunday morning. Thank you for joining me. knows best.
Thank you for tuning in and listening to Annie Latin Jazzy Rodriguez. Until we meet again, stay blessed and don't forget to keep it smooth. Have a good night.